it does seem that psychedelics, you know, in the right context, could have a profound effect that could change someone's life.
This is The Dime. Dive into the cannabis and hemp industry through trends, insights, predictions, and tangents.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Dime. I'm Brian Fields, and with me, as always, is Kellen Finney. And this week, we've got a very special guest, Dr. Matthew Johnson, professor at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Johnson, thanks for taking the time. How are you doing today?
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me. Doing good.
Excited to dive in. Kellen, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Really excited to talk to Dr. Johnson. Really excited to dive into, you know, psychedelics and all the fun stuff that's going on in the world right now. But more importantly, how are you doing today, Brian?
Yeah, I'm excited. There are a lot of information that we need some clarity on from Matt Johnson. And I think it's the right time, especially with psychedelics and all the compounds and information coming out. But before we kind of dive into some of those specifics, we've got a very aggressive East Coast, West Coast battle here. And just for the record, Dr. Johnson, which side do you choose?
I got to be East Coast. I mean, I grew up mid-Atlantic. I went to college in Oregon, but been back on the East Coast since grad school, so 25 years or so. So I gotta go with my East Coast tribe.
I love it. Let the record state, Callan. So,
and since at least one of you is a fellow East Coaster, like you can feel free to call me Matt. Appreciate the Dr. Johnson intro, but we can be real and call me Matt.
So Matt, for our listeners unfamiliar about you, can you give it a little background about yourself and kind of how you got into psychedelic research?
Yeah, so I have a PhD in experimental psychology, so I don't focus on treating disorders like a clinical psychologist, although I have very similar training, but I certainly have been trained in the, you know, various psychological disorders, but more in understanding the behavior, how to conduct science to understand people's psychology, what makes people tick, how they behave in certain situations. And a big focus of my research, really going back to grad school and even going back to college, I dabbled in some cocaine research. Big focus has been behavioral pharmacology, which is kind of a fancy way of saying studying drugs, what we think of as psychoactive drugs, whether they're legal, illegal, but drugs that affect the mind. So mentioned did some cocaine research that was in rats, but then in grad school did work with actually a number of different drugs. Did a lot with tobacco smoking. And as a scientist, I certainly, you know, caffeine, alcohol, tobacco, these are all drugs, you know, like, again, legal, illegal is kind of like just this superficial societal thing. But did a lot of work understanding addiction, you know, to a lot of these substances and what the, from a behavioral economics lens, understanding the decision making surrounding that. Did a lot of work understanding how nicotine and regulated tobacco consumption, how people would respond under different conditions to choose to smoke. Applied a lot of kind of decision making models to understand kind of these traps people get into, whether it's alcohol or caffeine or you name it, like if addiction, where there's a competition between short-term and long-term rewards, and kind of applied that to a lot of different substances. Moving into my postdoc work, I got more involved with sort of more drug administration research beyond just tobacco in humans. So cocaine and alcohol, methamphetamine, benzodiazepines, like some of the downers, the sleeping anti-anxiety drugs, GHB, a long, long list. But in that time, I got involved with psychedelic work as well back in 2004 and been doing it ever since. And so I've continued studying the other drugs throughout. I have had a long line of research for years supported by the US government, NIH, and studying the sexual risk behavior associated with certain drugs. So I do things like get people loaded up on cocaine or alcohol or methamphetamine in the lab and then ask them these hypothetical sexual decisions, whether they'd have sex with certain photos of, you know, you show photos of people. Would you have sex with or without a condom? What would you do if you had to wait an hour to get a condom? And some stuff like that, which sounds kind of crazy, but it actually stumbled upon some, I think, important, you know, findings to determine like what's kind of really driving the risk behavior, what kind of modulates like whether people are making risky or less risky choices with drugs. And then my work with psychedelics that whole time, again, since 2004, I've studied, you know, so-called healthy normals, which is kind of code for people without a disorder, so non-therapeutic studies. So the effects on personality, the effects on the subjective effects, such as this thing called mystical experience, long-term, you know, positive and negative outcomes, but it tends to be under prepared and, you know, structured conditions tends to be positive. And then moved into therapeutic applications, working with distressed cancer patients, some of which terminal, found long-term reductions in anxiety and depression. For about 15 years, I've had this line of research with smoking cessation, helping people quit tobacco smoking, kind of combining my, you know, long-term interest in understanding tobacco and nicotine going back to grad school and using psilocybin in this case as a treatment for that. I've done work with depression for the last number of years with psilocybin. I also did some work with some more exotic psychedelics, including salvinorin A, which is the active agent and primary active agent anyway, and salvia divinorum, which is still legal in most places. Did some high dose work with dextromethorphan, even compared to psilocybin. So this would be so-called robo-tripping. It's a ketamine relative. It's in a cough syrup, but very psychedelic. But that, and continue to look at, you know, psychedelics. I've got I received the first government grant since the 1960s, looking at the therapeutic applications of one of the classic psychedelics. So this is psilocybin, continuing the line of psilocybin to help with tobacco addiction. So that's where I spend most of my time these days, but have some other, you know, irons in the fire in the psychedelic world.
So back in 2004, psychedelics did not have the kind of societal or cultural acceptance, I would say. I mean, they're not completely accepted now, but it's definitely more mainstream than it was in 2004. So when you're first getting into that kind of work, what was like the motivation? Was there hesitancy? Kind of like talk us through those early days in the early 2000s.
It was something that I wanted to, you know, research. Going back to really my college days when I uncovered this kind of this history, I remember being at the college library, and this is, believe it or not, this is the 90s. Like this was, I mean, the internet existed, but it was like telnet text only type of like craziness. This is like, you know, in the library, you know, Dewey Decimal System card catalog, you know, reading all the books I could on psychedelics, discovering that older history of people using like, you know, LSD to treat alcoholism and the existential distress from terminal cancer from that and other things back in that older era and kind of discovering that history. And so, you know, with that combined with just my growing kind of just interest in across the board behavioral pharmacology, like how these psychoactive drugs can affect behavior, even like caffeine, how does like, you know, drinking a bunch of cups of coffee will just keep you up all night and like make you, you know, help you get a lot more work done. It's like, what's going on with that? Or people, you know, getting drunk and people being friendlier and like more relaxed and doing things they wouldn't normally do. And the good, the bad, the ugly across all of these substances. And so I was just fascinating with like, I got hooked on drugs, or I should say drug research, to be clear. You know, I really got hooked on this, like this understanding of like, how does that happen? How do you just have these little molecules that somehow affect the brain that then have these profound effects, and including things like someone becoming a hardcore alcoholic or addicted to heroin, et cetera, or positive, you know, using these, you know, substances towards benefit, you know, whether social relaxation or, yeah, getting some more work done with a stimulant. But within that broader context, the psychedelics always stood out. And I tell people, if they have this interest in the science of psychoactive drugs, either they have to be fascinated with psychedelics or they don't know much about them. Because this is like, I mean, the indigenous cultural use where they've been held in this kind of sacred way by a bunch of different cultures for, you know, apparently by the evidence going back to prehistorical times. And then you see the massive changes that they had in our society since the 60s. I mean, the claims by artists, like, you know, musicians and countless, even Nobel Prize winner Kary Mullis said he wouldn't have been able to invent PCR, which revolutionized biology, if it wasn't for having had psychedelic experiences. He when you look at all that, you think, well, this is not, it's like the Sesame Street, game, you know, which one of these things is not like the other. Like this kind of really stands out. And if you're interested as a psychologist in behavior change, which was really a thread of my interest throughout my career. It's like, how do substances affect behavior? And how can we affect positive behavior change? For example, people who are addicted, who want to quit whatever substance, how do we help them? How do we give them the tools that make them more successful? Like, I mean, psychedelics are just, I mean, they're weird. Like, you hear these stories even before the modern research of, I mean, there was the older work with LSD, but these stories from, you know, med people say, you know, they were a heavy drinker until they just took acid for fun one time. And then they just had this, like, this transformative experience. And they thought, what am I doing? And then, I mean, I published research on it by this point, documenting, you know, it doesn't prove it, it's not a clinical trial, but just documenting these stories where people claim that doing, you know, largely, you know, mushrooms or LSD helped them quit drinking, quit smoking, using cocaine, opioids, even cannabis. People that claimed some type of a problem with one of these substances where they were using it too much or had, you know, were using it in a harmful way, that they either drastically cut down or in a lot of cases, you know, totally stopped these substances because of an experience with a psychedelic. And typically the person wasn't even looking to do that. They just took, you know, they took mushrooms for fun because their buddy scored some, they were curious, you know. It wasn't like some deep shamanistic intent or therapeutic intent. And they just had this overview look of their life and made this change. Like, that's different. I don't know of any other substance where there's that type of used it one time and had a transformative positive effect on their life. Even with something like cannabis, where there's like countless therapeutic and, you know, in many cases, like clearly legitimate, you know, positive and therapeutic claims, it tends to be palliative and more in line with traditional mental health medications in the sense that there's typically not one use. You know, someone says they smoked pot once and it changed their life and they never touched it again. You know, it's like, no, you got that effect, you know, they've used it, you know, to one degree or another, they've continued to use it. But, you know, I'm never familiar with any other case with another substance where there's been this, like, you know, from a single instance, there's been this, like, decades long claim that it changed the direction of their life in a positive way. There's plenty of people that killed someone, you know, driving drunk or, you know, had a stroke when they on coke or something like that was a long-term negative in their life from one use, but they kind of stand out in that way. So that kind of summarizes my, like, why the heck, why am I interested in psychedelics? Like, why would that be interesting to a psychologist that wants to understand behavior change?
Was the first time you heard a story of like a breakthrough like this, where it was like a one dose and they were instantly fixed or improved? Were you skeptical and then you continued to look into it? I mean, you had to have been slightly skeptical just hearing kind of like the complete change, because typically that's rare. Exactly like you said, you're not aware of any other compounds that can do this. So take us through kind of that early feeling of the skepticism and then working through some of the things that kind of solidified your belief that this could be something that's a game changer.
Yeah, my skepticism kind of was around and still is actually probably even more so, just kind of the broader, like, you know, to what degree does someone really change? Like, so I don't know. One of my things I focus on a lot is like, you know, using any of these substances doesn't necessarily make you a good person. You know, I think the changes are relatively, you know, targeted, which can have a profound impact on someone's life. So, you know, there is some skepticism about the overblown claims. So I had met people that, for example, quit, you know, drinking from 12 steps or like, and had one of these kind of aha experiences outside of psychedelics. So, I mean, it seemed clear to me, like, as a training psychologist, even before that in college, that like sometimes people do have big experiences in their life that, where they change. It's not kind of aha moments where that changed their life. So it seemed credible that you could have these, that psychedelics could be leveraged towards that. And so it might be a little weird because one of the things I tell people to be skeptical of is that it's become very fashionable for psychedelic scientists that say they were such a skeptic and then they saw the results from their first study and then their eyes were opened and how did you get to the point? At least if you didn't think it was a decent bet, how did you get to the point where you Like, let me tell you, it is really hard to do human research, especially with the Schedule I substance. You have to put in oftentimes years of work to get to that point just to dose somebody. And like, it wasn't like you did this on a whim. Oh, let's do this experiment. And so take that with a grain of salt. It makes a good story. It makes for a good story. Please believe me, I was such a hard-nosed, rigorous, skeptical scientist, but I was so shocked by the results. It's okay to be a scientist and you should be open if the data tells you something else, but it's okay to have your guesses. Yeah, like my best bet is that, I don't know, birds are more likely to fly than ungulates. Like it's like you can observe the natural world and see certain patterns, and it doesn't mean you can't do an experiment and you shouldn't be open to the results, but it doesn't make you a bad scientist for having a hypothesis. Or, you know, to use plain language, have a really strong guess. You know, your gut tells you, I think there's something there. And looking at the world and all the stories, it does seem that psychedelics, you know, in the right context could have a profound effect that could change someone's life. So I thought that was probably the case going back to college when I started like kind of understand the history and, you know, talking to people that have, you know, had profound, you know, effects from psychedelics. And so, you know, it doesn't make it scientifically, it's not the same as running a clinical trial and seeing some evidence. But yeah, I was never sort of like, I didn't have that aha moment in terms of like, I was blown away by my own research. I mean, I have been blown away, I guess, by the magnitude. It really is impressive. And how sometimes you just see like the participants after the sessions and they're just like describing this experience, and it's not always the case, but sometimes it's just overwhelming where they just it's so meaningful to them and it's so clear to them that this has really changed something. And sometimes you do get these like really huge aha moments where you just think like this has got to be good, like they're going to leverage this is going to have a lasting impact, and like, oh yeah, that's why all the paperwork is worth it to do this research to see these effects and to document them if they are real, you know, for in least some conditions, like to let people know, let the world know, hey, take this seriously. We need to look more into this. And if it passes muster with the FDA, et cetera, like make it available to people.
So with most drugs, the dose makes the poison, right? And so throughout your career, you've been focused on dose a lot, right? In terms of trying to figure out, and I'm guessing you're trying to figure out if there's a specific quantity of these chemicals that you ingest that could potentially facilitate that aha moment, right? Mm-hmm. And so kind of talk us through like how you choose the dose, where that kind of comes from within the literature, and how that has impacted a lot of your studies going forward.
So yeah, and I've done a number of studies using different doses. Probably the biggest was when they used 4 different doses of psilocybin plus a placebo in healthy normal people. But looking at these were sort of very therapeutically meaningful outcomes that show a relationship to the therapeutic outcomes in the clinical studies. You know, things like mystical experience. The results seem to be in line with the older literature of, you know, what you would call heroic doses for psychedelics, for these classic psychedelics. Like, and a lot of people, especially with the whole microdosing thing that's in vogue, a lot of people get it confused. They assume these are like, you know, yeah, this is a study, you know, like it's, you guys are kind of using a sissy dose. I haven't mentioned, but some of the work with psychedelics, including some of the novel psychedelics, like comparing dextromethorphan to psilocybin. Yeah. Sometimes people have come in those studies. We want the connoisseur, the person that could say, oh, this was like taking, you know, 2-CI and then like smoking some 5-methoxy-DMT after the peak one time. And like I had this, you know, the connoisseur, like, you know, so you want those people, the psychonauts. That's your perfect subject there, your participant. I've had plenty of those people get our high dose that we give to people of psilocybin and just be like, holy, holy shit, you guys were not kidding me. Like, you know, and sometimes they say like that was the most powerful psychedelic they've ever had. Maybe part of it was the introspective framework with the eye shades, but the dose is just straight up huge. And so I always like to tell people it's not only more than a microdose, But compared to a regular, like a recreational dose, and there's obviously variation, you know, but what's typical, like what someone might want to take if they're taking it at a concert or even at a festival, even like Burning Man, like this is more than that. This is the heroic dose range, which is.
Can you give us like some sort of like boundaries to demonstrate like microdosing, recreational range, and then heroic dose?
Yeah. And again, caveats to all of this because, you know,
everyone's different.
Yeah. And especially if we talk about mushrooms, because it's like just like oranges vary in vitamin C and sugar, like mushrooms are going to vary in psilocybin and psilocin contents. But the high dose being in terms of psilocybin, 30 milligrams or higher, you know, I guess you could count, you know, probably 25 and higher. Most of the work I've done is 30 milligrams, typically body weight adjusted. So have people over about 150 pounds get a higher dose. So oftentimes they're getting 45, 50 if they're a heavier person. We published some research suggesting you don't really need to do that. So the work going forward doesn't adjust for body weight. But that 30 milligrams, and this will probably be meaningful for a lot of people, is roughly equivalent to what Terrence McKenna, for those familiar with him, would call the heroic dose of Psilocybe cubensis mushroom, so 5 dried grams, based on average mushroom potency done by scientific analyses. So just make that real for people. You know, it wouldn't be uncommon for, you know, someone to, you know, score some mushrooms and friends are, you know, going to take them together. They'll split an 1/8 ounce of mushrooms 2 or 3 ways. You know, and that's not going to be a microdose. That's going to, and I should say a microdose is sort of, opinions vary, but something like 1/2 gram of mushrooms, like pretty small amount, like sort of if it's powdered and packed into a capsule, it's like 1 or less than 1 capsule, depending on the capsule size. But, and it's typically conceived of as like sort of 1/20th of what a full psychedelic dose is, roughly speaking. But, you know, so a recreational dose might be sort of and you know, splitting an 1/8 ounce of mushrooms 2 or 3 ways. I guess I'm going across, you know, grams and ounces. So what an ounce would be, you know, about 28 grams. So what an 1/8 would be something like a little over three grams. So a microdose would be like less than 1 gram, maybe 1/2 gram. And 3 milligrams or 5 dried grams would be somewhere between 1/8 ounce and 1/4 ounce of mushrooms. That's not split 2 or 3 ways. That's one person taking it. So one person taking almost 1/4 ounce of mushrooms or something pretty much in between 1/8 and 1/4 ounce of mushrooms by themselves. So, I mean, some people with experience out there might be, you know, saying, whoa, like, you know, that, yeah, that's not what you want to take it. That's, there's always exceptions. There's always that knucklehead that like, well, they'll take anything anywhere. But like, if someone's a Burning Man, they probably want to like get back in their tent, zip up for the night. Like they're not even like able to walk around the playa. Like, you know, just
shut it down for the
focus
night.
On breathing. Like,
yeah,
that's what you can handle. Like
for 8 hours,
no public, like, yeah, interactions. So it's a true, and the thing about psychedelic compared to all those other drugs I've studied is you can give a dose that's like really overwhelming at the psychological subjective level without it being dangerous physiologically. Now there is an exception if someone's at severe risk of heart disease, anything that pushes your blood pressure and pulse up even modestly could give you a heart attack or stroke. And so, I mean, there's some people going up a couple flights of stairs at work is dangerous and their doctor tells them not to. It's people that, you know, have cardiac events having sex and they end up in the ER or they die. And so anything that gets the blood going is, you know, and so most of these psychedelics are in that category, including psilocybin. But for most healthy people that aren't at the severe risk of heart disease, there's no known lethal overdose. I mean, you could take 100 times what we intend to give as a high dose, and there's no way that it's going to kill your liver. It's going to make you stop breathing. It's going to give you a fatal cardiac event. That's the way, those 3 ways are kind of the way most drugs, if you take too much, will kill you in, with kind of the big exceptions being many of the classic psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin, and of course cannabis being the other big exception. But you know, you can't go to the drugstore and buy over-the-counter stuff you can expect to live and take 10, 20, 30, 100 times the dose and expect to live. You can't do that with caffeine, aspirin, you know, certainly not Tylenol. I think like sort of like three times the tenant dose could kill you. So it's remarkably safe at the physiological level for most people. So you really can have these profoundly strong subjective effects. Another caveat is like nothing is safe. You know, it's all about what are the risks. And so at the behavioral level, like, yeah. And it's relatively rare, but it has happened. Like, this is a really powerful subjective experience. If you're walking around in public, you can get in an accident. You can freak out and panic with a bad trip, run across the highway, get hit by a car. And even though it sounds like 60s era propaganda, and I think it's really rare, there are convincing cases, I think, you know, like of people that are so out there, like they think they can fly. Like, there's been some cases where it looks like that has happened. And I think that people who have really had very strong psychedelic experiences, they're humble enough to think that, yeah, not typical, but
possible.
Awesome. They could see how that could happen if you're really out there and no one's watching your back. And so, again, I don't want to, you know, propagandize and scare people. It is very rare, but that has happened. And these are really – so you could – you know, it's more likely you're going to do something that, like, whatever, just embarrass yourself or, you know, for most, you know, or
make a good story, you mean?
Yeah. End up, you know, pissing yourself and you're, I don't know, or something, you know, hauled out by the security and then, like, paramedics and cops at a concert and then all that just, you know, like, spirals the, you know, whatever, the panic and, you know, have some horror story like that. But yeah, it's like they're really intoxicating substances at high doses. So that's more of where the relevant risk for most people is at. Just doing something stupid when you're like really, really high, typically in public, is where the relevant risk tends to be at.
So with microdosing continues to rise with popularity, my question to you is there any literature that demonstrates it has benefits for the individual, or is it more so potentially placebo effect? And if it is placebo sec, does it matter if people are feeling better after?
Yeah, that last part's really, that's a tough one. So the literature, and so there hasn't been a lot of studies. There's been a few studies. The ones that have really like looked into it carefully in the lab haven't yet found benefit of microdosing any of the claims of antidepressant. So we know there it's at least part through some like self-blinding research that Imperial College has done. It seems like a lot of the claimed benefit, if not all, is placebo effect, which shouldn't be surprising. In fact, most of like on the ground medicine, and what you want is a combination of hopefully real efficacy plus placebo, because placebo means the power of the mind to have essentially what you could call miraculous effects and sort of the power the mind over healing, both physically and in this case, like mentally in many cases. So you want to harness that clinically. At the same time, you don't want to approve medications that are purely operating on this, because most things have at least some risk. And 100 years ago, people were selling like literally like snake oil. That's where the name came, and other things that, you know, and spending their life fortunes because their kid is dying of some disease. And rather than getting a treatment that may work there, you know, so there's a good reason we have the FDA. And so you don't want to rely completely on the placebo effect. So it needs to be worked out. But my best guess is that there may be some efficacy to the antidepressant effects, because we've known for 80 years that chronically giving drugs of various types, whether they the SSRIs starting in the 80s or the older generations of antidepressants, that chronically augmenting the serotonin system in one way or another can help alleviate depressive symptoms to some degree for some people. And so it wouldn't be surprised if, you know, and to be clear for folks, unlike the heroic dose model where people take it once or twice, three times in clinical setting, then you see therapeutic benefits in many cases, you know, 6 months, a year, more than that later. Microdosing is about taking it on a regular basis, usually not every day, but once every few days. There's different models, once every 2, 3, 4 days, a couple times a week, something like that. And so, you know, it wouldn't be that surprising if chronically, you know, taking a serotonergic drug led to antidepressant effects. So that's where my strongest bets would be. There might be something there, but so far, the few laboratory studies haven't found that. They basically found people are a little bit intoxicated, like your ability to judge time is a little off, which is like totally fine and even great if you're like lying on the couch in the heroic dose model where you're wearing the eye shades and you're having this introspective, you know, experience. But the idea with microdosing is you're going about your daily, you know, like if you're driving to work, you're taking care of your kid, like whatever, like you want to have accurate time perception. You don't want to be less than accurate. You know, it's like being a little bit intoxicated. So, which isn't surprising, given that you're a whole lot intoxicated if you take a really big dose. And people feel a little bit, basically feel a little bit high, you know, which might be consistent with the antidepressant effects, although that's a complex discussion of like, you know, the original antidepressants were stimulants like amphetamine, and like why they help you not feel good. There's also then like the, is there tolerance to that? Is it, well, in the case of amphetamines, there can be addiction to that, which is, doesn't appear to be the case for these drugs. That's the other thing in terms of the safety. It doesn't appear that the classic psychedelics like psilocybin and LSD are addictive, even though they can be abused, meaning used dangerously. So the last part of your question, I think, was like, you know, is it okay if it is just pure placebo effect? And that's complex. I mean, to be clear, I think people should just be warned. I don't think any of these substances should be, you know, criminalized. I think for the public, I, you know, just want to give people the information. This is what we know is riskier versus less risky use. You know, I think people should be free with education and to know what they're doing and to be, you know, armed to be as safe as possible, whatever they're doing, if they choose to use. But if it is purely the placebo effect, there is some concern. We don't know a whole lot, but like say if there's a little bit of impairment, then, and to be clear, sometimes like people get their dose wrong and because, you know, people are sloppy and sometimes people think they're microdosing and then it's like, whoa, they're at work or driving and they're like, oh, okay, I'm pulling over. Like, gotta wait this out, you know? But even if you have a control over the dose, there's some reason to have concern. Like there's some, theoretically, anything that has an effect on the serotonin B system, which is not the psychedelics work, the classic psychedelics work mainly through activating serotonin A receptors, but most of them also activate serotonin B receptors, which is 2B receptors, serotonin 2B receptors. There is evidence that activating them can lead to heart valve disease. And so this is why this drug Fen-Phen was pulled from the market back in the 80s, or maybe it was the early 90s. But because it was discovered after it was approved, a bunch of people were having heart valvulopathy, you know, heart valve disease. There was a hardening of the tissue in the heart valves. And so and that's been worked out pretty well that it's like, yeah, activating this receptor can lead to that. So that doesn't, you know, that's really not a concern if you're talking about these heroic dose models where you're taking it a few times. But if you start talking about, oh, you're going to take this thing twice a week for the next 5 years, all of a sudden that becomes a relevant question. No one really knows. There are people, even scientists, that say, oh, that's, we don't know that's the case. That's, you know, don't scare people. That's a bunch of hogwash. It might be, but like even we just, the thing is like no one knows. Like if there's a 10% chance that that's true, which, you know, that might be the case. Like, we don't know, like if it's true, it's probably not true, perhaps. I mean, again, no one really knows, but like, even if it's a 10% chance, I'd want to know that. Cause there's some people saying if there's a 10% chance of getting heart disease, like, yeah, you know, they want to see their daughter graduate from high school. Like, they're like, no, thank you. I don't want to do that. You know? So I'm just, there is a theoretical reason that chronically taking this could be an issue. And unfortunately, given the legal landscape, I always like to remind people another risk is legality. Like just because it's in vogue, you know, don't forget that, because I remind people like a few years ago, like there's this, you know, some headlines about a CEO and I think Silicon Valley, and he was bragging about microdosing. He got canned, like, yeah, dropped from the board, and they're like, dude, you're like going public about using a Schedule I substance. And like, I mean, Elon had some bad repercussions just for smoking a blunt with Joe Rogan that time. I mean,
every single SpaceX employee has to get drug tested now because he smoked weed on Joe Rogan podcast.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, wow. Isn't that wild? That was the repercussion. Every single SpaceX employee now gets drug tested because he smoked the joint on the Joe Rogan podcast.
Which is crazy, as if like either that was or wasn't a concern. before, no, like
it sucks for them.
What is it? Yeah, like that's just crazy. So I think there may be a possibility there's something real there with the creativity. I would put higher bets on the fact that there's creative outcomes from high doses of psychedelics, yes, just because the anecdotes are like in the millions. Like,
yeah. And everyone who's done it has been
right.
Like,
hey, I always that's remind people there's the Beatles before and after LSD. And like that was a big difference. Not a controlled experiment, but like, so I don't know. There could be something with the microdosing. And we haven't done, as a field, we haven't done the best experiments yet, you know? So that's still, even with high doses, we don't know. There's scant evidence that leads to creativity, but I think that's a really good bet. At least within, and creativity can mean a lot of things. Like, what is it? My guess is that it would, even like high doses would lead to a kind of a broader selection of ideas. And the way creativity works is that, you know, you have it's like natural selection. You have all this variability. Some of it works out. And so you might get it, and some of it doesn't. So like, you know, like variations in the genome, it's like some lead to great success and some like early death. And so it may be that psychedelics increase all kinds of like creative, like, you know, wild ideas. Some of those are great ideas and others are really stupid ideas. And so it may depend on how you, that would be my guess, you know, but we need wild thinkers and we need to then sift through like, what are the great from crazy ideas? I think a lot of the very creative folks, they're like that. Like if you look, they actually have some ideas that didn't work out, but thank goodness they existed, because we need folks to go out there and kind of cast the nets wide, and either those people, or in many cases, other people have more of the skills and interest in vetting out, like out of those possibilities, what holds up and what is wishful thinking. So I would put more bets on that high doses lead to creativity, but certainly a possibility that low doses, that micro doses do as well. We're not sure. It's mainly anecdote at this point.
Let's slightly switch gears and do a quick rapid fire.
Mm-hmm.
True or false, cannabis is addictive?
Yes. I'll leave it true. I want to put a caveat in there, but most people that try it don't become addicted. And the consequences of that, I'm defying your rules, Brian. I'm sorry.
It's fine.
The consequences of people that have a problem stopping are nowhere near what they are for alcohol and many other addictives. But yes, it can. People have, some people, a subset of users have trouble stopping when they want to stop. It's very clear. Yeah.
The number one thing a majority of society gets wrong about psychedelics?
They don't necessarily lead you to become more ethical, better people. Necessarily.
True or false, all drugs have the same, roughly, abuse potential?
False.
True or false, the psychology of xenophobia hinders the public's understanding of the medicinal benefits of psychedelics?
Oh, definitely true.
A compound you have not studied but are most intrigued about?
5-methoxy-DMT.
If psychedelics therapies fail or never make it, what's the number one reason why?
Overzealous enthusiasm.
What researchers or studies are a must read for you?
The old days, the first big group that doesn't get the attention, the Saskatchewan group that first discovered psychedelic therapy, Humphrey Osmond, Abram Hoffer, Duncan Blewett, etc.
If you could put anything on a billboard, metaphorically speaking, to get a message to billions of people, it could be an image, a quote or word or something that inspired you, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Oh, that's a good one. Rapid fire. Think beyond yourself.
Ethics and money are no issue. What research or study would you do?
Examining whether psychedelics can, at least in some cases, lead to like telepathic abilities and psi phenomenon like that.
Have you ever felt strongly one way pre-study only to be surprised or shocked after it concluded?
Yeah, with psychedelics? Yes.
What was the study?
with Salvinorin A, the degree to which people were actually having claimed subjective entity contact, that astonished me. The frequency with which that happened, and that certain people claimed even had incidental therapeutic effects from it, which doesn't seem to be a common like reported anecdote with at least smoking salvia divinorum.
What's your current perspective on the state of psychedelic research? Do you believe it's cult-like?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of cult vibes.
Why?
I think it's the same kind of mistakes that people make in other areas. I think there's a lot of hero worship. And I don't know. I know people can say, well, you know, I'm trying to like, whatever. Like, I want to be I've done a lot of work in the area and I like talking to the public and let them know what I know. But at the same time, it's like, I'm just a person. I just want to remind people. I'm just like someone had an interest in this stuff and went to school long enough to study it. And so I think people need to check their egos. I think there's a lot of ego inflation amongst certain scientists, not all for sure, but there's a weird hero worship. I think there are scientists and clinicians that want to fill in the blanks for people. Like, because when people have a huge psychedelic experience, oftentimes they confront the big questions. Does God exist? What's the meaning in life? What's the nature of reality? Like when people often say it's the most meaningful experience of their life, like that's easily taken advantage of, which can also include stuff like sexual abuse and inappropriate relationships between like sleeping with your clients and this type of thing. It's probably even more likely with you're giving people psychedelic sessions, man. There can be like this hero worship of like, you're the access to the divine or what have you, which we could see where that in the cases of religions and other areas where that by a subset can be radically abused. Yeah. And so that's very real for a very real potential for the psychedelic area. You're going to see clinicians like sleeping with half their patients and like having sessions at their house and being the would-be guru. You're going to see that like that type of stuff, even from, you know, credentialed doctors.
5 years from now, what research, what breakthroughs, what do you think has changed from the landscape?
Well, I certainly think based on the trajectory we're going to have, depending on the FDA and the EMA in Europe, but a multiple approved MDMA and psilocybin will probably be approved by that point for multiple disorders, depression, various substance use disorders, maybe end of life care. We'll probably figure out a few more things about how it's working in the brain, but in the big picture, probably not within that time frame. There'll be a lot more research with other psychedelics by that point. And we will have studied other disorders, and we'll probably find out for certain things that it doesn't work. Like, it wouldn't be surprising if the research like anorexia and some other things, you know, didn't quite work out, because there's going to be boundary conditions. Nothing's going to work for everything. And yeah.
All right, Matt, prediction time. Matt, kids, drugs, and a developing brain. Do you think we will see studies done on the potential benefits for kids? If so, do you have any guesses on where there could be a big opportunity?
Yeah, in therapeutic populations, for sure. In fact, FDA incentivizes it. They want it. And MAPS has plans to do that with MDMA. And so this makes sense, because there's a risk in like not treating severe PTSD and not treating depression that could lead to suicide. And so and FDA is clear, and I've talked with them on this. They want these studies. And the way it works is if something's approved for adults, then you move on to say, okay, you start with the older, you know, minors. So I forget the particular categories of ranges, like, but they'll say you start 16 to 18 years old, or 16 to 17 year olds, you start there. Yeah, but you can go too far with that. Everyone is like, as a parent, I could say it's understandable. It's like people are really risk averse when it comes to kids. But you need to be balanced and, again, realize that, like, yeah, untreated mental health disorders in kids, in adolescents, and perhaps younger is also, a real risk, you know. And so you just want to be cautious. You just want to be principled and cautious and not let some theoretical concern, some like bumper stick level like concern, keep you from, you know, responsibly making the inquiry.
Kellen?
I agree with what Matt has to say. I mean, I'm thinking about how many children have had really like traumatic experiences that then they've kind of carried them with like in their psyche for, you know, a decade plus, and then they hit their like mid-20s or mid-30s and they're like, oh wow, like I've had all these issues throughout my life because I never dealt with this super traumatic experience I had when I was 12, right? Because, you know, and all of this, these negative outcomes from just kind of putting it under the rug and not dealing with it. I think that there's an opportunity for like what you've seen with psilocybin or MDMA to really kind of approach that experience and be able to eliminate it or remedy it early on in that person's life, extending the quote unquote happiness they can experience for multiple decades. So I do think that there's a massive potential there, but just as Matthew is saying, like there are so many obstacles that are going to have to be overcome and significant caution is going to have to be undertaken when you're performing, giving a child a psychoactive compound like that. So it's a lot of work to be done, but what do you think, Brian?
I think at the end of the day, if these compounds can help people and there are scientific benefits that demonstrate that these change people's lives and can make a difference for them, I think it's important that we look to do that. I think exactly like you said, Kellen, that these kids that have PTSD and these traumatic events early on in their lives that influence them later on, just affording them an opportunity to maybe reset or to move forward. Obviously, that'll entail a ton of science behind it in order to confirm those claims. But I think helping others is one of the benefits that I think we as society can do a better job of looking to uncover whatever is necessary in order to help people do better in their lives.
And we should remember, like, we routinely give kids all kinds of psychoactive substances with, frankly, far worse. I mean, Adderall is amphetamine. I mean, that's just as addictive as cocaine. Like, we give kids, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be used ever. It's overused. I'm comfortable saying that. But, like, by a lot, in my opinion. But we routinely give kids all kinds of substances that are, including psychoactive substances, benzodiazepines, stimulants, that in the scheme of things, there's, I would say, far more reason to be concerned, especially compared to, say, you know, if the research supports it, you know, taking MDMA under professional medical like supervision in the clinic, you know, a couple of times to address PTSD or you know, maybe same thing with psilocybin for depression, for example, you know, like, again, risk benefit ratio, like it's all about helping people and not harming them.
Perfectly well said. So Matt, for our listeners, they want to get in touch, they want to read more, where can they find you?
Probably the best place is follow me on Twitter or X, as they say these days, at drug_researcher.
Awesome. We'll link it up in the show notes. Thanks for taking the time. This was fun.
Oh, my pleasure, guys.
Guys, if you've enjoyed this podcast over the last few years, can you please take 3 minutes or less and leave us a quick review on Apple or Spotify? All reviews make a massive difference for us and help other people like you find this podcast. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Are you looking for the next great cannabis business to invest in? Then you need to check out the MJ Bulls podcast. Hi, I'm Dan Humiston. Join me each week as I speak to both cannabis entrepreneurs who are raising capital and cannabis investors who are investing capital. Our 10-minute episodes are perfect for the busy investor. Start listening to the MJ Bulls podcast today, wherever you listen to podcasts, and who knows, maybe you'll discover the next cannabis unicorn.